far from sure he'd heard right. Like clay?
Yes, he makes things that people can't use. Useless. Like the man.
Carl Tracy was an artist, thought Gamache. But then, why not? Having known many artists in his life, especially through Clara, he'd grown to realize they were often not the most stable or house-trained individuals.
When was the last time you were called to the home? Gamache asked. 2 weeks ago. Again, she refused help.
Why would she call, then refuse help? Asked Cloutier. It doesn't make sense.
She just wanted the beating to stop, said Cameron. But she didn't want him arrested. I think she knew he'd be out in hours, and then things would get really bad.
Gamache nodded. It was a terrible flaw in the system. It appeared to help the abused, while actually just piling on more abuse. Worse abuse.
There was nothing more we could do, really, said Cameron.
Really?
Sir?
Asked Cameron. You said there was nothing you could do, really. Gamache let that sit for a moment. But was there something you did do? Cameron hesitated before finally answering.
I took Carl aside when I saw him in town last week. I warned him.
What did you say? Asked Gamache.
I told him I knew what he was doing to his wife, and if there was one more complaint, I'd beat the shit out of him.
You did what? Asked Gamache, while beside him Cloutier muttered, Good. Gamache stood up and faced the mammoth man. The small room grew even smaller, suffocating. That was the wrong thing to do, said Commander Flaubert, recognizing that something needed to be said, though her tone was without real reproach.
Why was it wrong? Asked Cameron, addressing Gamache. He needed to know.
Know what? Asked Gamache. That cops with an ID card and a gun will be judge and jury and carry out the sentence? Did you want him to know that punishing one beating with another is the way we do things in the Sûreté? Did you want to cede all moral high ground?
Gamache spoke clearly and slowly, choosing his words carefully and swallowing the ones that were screaming to get out. Though his outrage was evident, in his extreme stillness, and in each tightly controlled word.
Threats of violence will not be tolerated. You're an officer in the Sûreté de Québec, not a thug. You set the tone, the atmosphere. You act as a role model, either consciously or unconsciously.
My concern was for a vulnerable woman, a pregnant woman, and her unborn child, not for the entire population of Quebec.
The two are the same. No citizen is safe in a state where police feel free to beat those they don't like, who take the law into their own hands.
And you didn't? Asked Cameron.
Agent Cameron, snapped Commander Flaubert. It was too late. The words were out. The line had been crossed. Cloutier's mouth dropped open, but she said nothing. Just stared at the two men, staring at each other.
I did, said Gamache, and paid the price. Knew I would. Knew I should. You seem to think you're perfectly within your rights to threaten assault. To maybe even do it, without censure.
Cameron couldn't deny that.
At what stage did you think a threat of violence was appropriate?
At the stage, sir, when I realized the law could not protect Vivian Godin.
So you would, by piling violence on violence.
If you'd seen her...
I've seen worse.
The truth of that, the horror of that, pressed up against them in the tiny room.
I'm not saying what was happening to Vivian Godin was all right, Gamache went on more gently. Of course it wasn't. Of course it's tempting to do something, anything, to stop it. It's horrific when, as people sworn to protect, we cannot. When someone we know to be guilty is beyond our reach. When they can keep doing it and we can't stop it. But it's even worse if the cops become criminals too. Do you understand?
Yes, sir.
Do you really? Asked Gamache.
There was a pause as Agent Cameron considered, then finally nodded.
There's one other thing, said Gamache, his voice now back to normal. Did you consider what a threat like that would do to a man like Carl Tracy? Did you really think it would stop him from abusing his wife?
Or would it, could it, enrage him even more? And who would he take it out on? You or her? There was silence as Cameron considered a question he hadn't thought of before.
Consequences, said Gamache. We must always consider the consequences of our actions, or inaction. It won't necessarily change what we do, but we need to be aware of the effect. That's the contract we have with the people of Quebec, that those who have an ID card and a gun also have self-control.
Yes, sir.
Bon.
He at least now understood why Cameron hadn't gone to the farmhouse himself yesterday. Gamache sat down again.
Go on, Agent Cloutier.
The room, still tingling, settled back to near normal.
Do you know if Vivian has any friends we can contact? Cloutier asked. Anyone she might be with?
Cameron shook his head.
Tracy didn't provide any names, and no one's come forward or shown concern.
They were getting a picture of Vivian Godin's life, and what they saw was not good. A woman isolated in a remote farmhouse. It was, they knew, one of the warning signs of extreme abuse. Control.
Any gossip? Cloutier asked.
You mean an affair? Asked Cameron. Again, if there was, I never heard it.
And Tracy, does he have any friends?
Drinking buddies, said Cameron. But even they seem to have disappeared. Last time I saw him in town, he was drinking alone at the joint at the edge of town.
Name?
Asked Cloutier. She was getting the hang of this.
Le Lapin Grossier.
The Dirty Rabbit? She asked, as she wrote.
More like Filthy, said Cameron.
The Obscene Rabbit, said Flaubert. It's a strip joint.
The interview was winding down.
Thank you for your help, said Gamache, as he stood and took his coat off the back of the chair.
What are you going to do now, if you don't mind my asking? Said Cameron.
We're going to visit Monsieur Tracy, said Gamache.
Would you like me there?
Gamache paused. He'd been about to decline, given Cameron's last encounter with Carl Tracy, but now wondered if it mightn't work in their favour. While Cameron's threat to beat Tracy was wrong, it was done. Gamache, the realist, knew that showing up with this agent might just shake some truth loose.
If you don't mind, he asked the commander, who nodded.
That would be helpful. You can show us the way.
I'll get my coat, said Cameron.
After he left, the commander said,
I'm sorry he threatened Tracy. I didn't know about that.
Are you? Sorry.
Commander Flaubert reddened.
I understand why he did it.
Gamache thought for a moment, looking at the closed door through which the large man had disappeared.
The scars on his face, he said. Not from football.
No, those are thanks to his father.
Gamache took a deep breath and shook his head. Had Bob Cameron turned that hurt, that pain, that betrayal into something useful? Into sport? And now into protecting others? Or had he learned something else from his father? That day in the bitterly cold stands in Montreal again came to mind, wrapped in blankets with Reine-Marie and their son Daniel, watching the Grey Cup final, hearing the crashes and grunts and shouts from the field. The brutality, as the massive left tackle found his quarry and decked him, standing over the body and opening his arms in a primal display of domination. To wild applause, to approval. Was he still doing it? Only now in a Sûreté uniform. Once in the car, following Agent Cameron's vehicle, Gamache asked Agent Cloutier,
What do you think of him?
Cameron? I don't know.
Think about it.
She thought.
He called her Madame Godin, but when he got angry, he called her Vivian.
Oui. When you spoke with him this morning, did you mention she was pregnant?
Cloutier went back over the conversation.
No.
I see.
And yet, thought Gamache, Agent Cameron knew that Vivian was going to have a baby.
Now, how was that?
As they got closer to the farmhouse, the wipers pushing the wet flakes off the windshield, Agent Cloutier did what she always did in times of extreme stress.
2 times 4 is 8, 3 times 5 is 15. Her times tables, laid out neatly in rows and columns. 5 times 4 is... her meditation, her happy place. No chaos could survive in the tightly packed numbers. Everything in its place, in its home, safe, predictable, known. Every question had an answer. 20. Terrible things did not happen to the pregnant daughter of an old friend in the times table. 6 times 6 is... only, Cloutier knew, something had happened, and it was up to them to find the answer. 36. 36 hours, Vivian was now missing. Chapter 6.
What do you think? Gabri asked Clara as they stood on the stone bridge and looked into the Riviera Bella Bella below. He had to speak up over the roar. The water rushing beneath them, so clear and gentle in summer, was seething, frothing with brown foam and great chunks of ice and tree limbs swept into it in the spring runoff. All very natural, all very predictable. But there was a problem. There was too much of it, too much water, too much ice, far too much forest swirling in the waters. Gabri and Clara turned around and looked downriver.
Damn,
muttered Clara, and then, raising her voice, she turned to Gabri.
A dam is forming. I think it's time to start sandbagging.
Did someone say sandbagging?
Asked Ruth as she joined them on the bridge. She'd put a moth-eaten woolen scarf over her short white hair and tied it at her chin, so that she looked like an elderly Victorian gentleman with a toothache and a duck.
Now, Ruth, Gabri spoke with exaggerated patience, we've been through this before. When we call for volunteers to sandbag, we don't mean to hit each other over the head with sand-filled socks.
Shit, said Ruth.
No, said Gabri, not shit either, as we learnt last spring.
Clara had returned to the other side of the bridge and looked at her garden, which backed onto the Riviera Bella Bella. The river had risen rapidly in the last hour and was now just inches from the top.
I've never seen it so high so early, said Gabri, joining her.
Are you talking about the river or Ruth?
Asked Clara. Gabri laughed, then regarded their neighbour more closely. Ruth looked fairly sober, sombre even, though the duck looked bleary, but then ducks often did.
What do you think, Ruth?
Gabri asked, raising his voice so she could hear over the rushing waters and her natural inclination not to listen. She was the oldest resident of Three Pines, but how old was a matter of some debate.
We found her under a rock,
Gabri's partner Olivier was fond of explaining, and she did appear more than a little fossilized. She also happened to be the chief of the volunteer fire department, not because she was a natural leader, but because most villagers would rather run into a burning building or a river in full flood than face Ruth Zardo's sharp tongue. She tipped her head back and looked into the sky. It had stopped snowing, but was still threatening moisture of some sort. Exactly what they did not need.
I think we should order more sand, she said, dropping her eyes to consider the river below. I checked yesterday, and we have enough in the pile behind the old railway station for a normal flood, but this doesn't look normal to me.
If anyone had a knowledge of abnormal, it was Ruth.
I've only seen it this high once before, she said. Yes, I guess it's time.
For what?
Asked Clara.
Another 100-year flood.
Oh, shit, said Gabri. Fuckety-fuck-fuck. Mad.
Then he paused.
What's a 100-year flood?
Surely the name is a giveaway, said Clara.
They followed Ruth as she turned toward the bistro.
A 100-year flood happens every 100 years, right?
Gabri whispered to Clara.
I'd have to say yes.
Then how could Ruth have seen one before?
He dropped his voice still further.
How old is she?
Not a clue. I'm still trying to figure out how old the duck is, said Clara.
Just then, Rosa, in Ruth's arms a few paces ahead, turned her head 180 degrees and glared at them.
The devil duck, whispered Gabri. If her head spins all the way around, I'm running for the hills.
But Rosa just turned back and nestled into the crook of Ruth's arm and went to sleep, unaware of, or unconcerned about, the rising waters. But then, thought Clara, as they entered the bistro, ducks could fly, and people could not. Their tires spun in the thick mud, and the car slewed sideways on the hill. The spring thaw had once again brought hope and muck. It was a beautiful, filthy season.
Stop, stop, said Gamache. Arrête, he commanded when Cloutier gunned it one more time, and the car slipped a few more feet sideways toward the gully.
Up ahead, Cameron's patrol car was sliding backward toward them.
Back up, said Gamache. Slowly.
He kept his voice calm and level, even as he watched Cameron's vehicle gather speed on the steep slope.
What you want to do, he said, is...
I know, I know.
As he watched, she put the car in reverse and touched the gas, nursing it backward. Gamache braced, watching Cameron's car coming at them, even as Cloutier applied gas and theirs sped up. There was a small thud as the Sûreté vehicles met. Cloutier expertly nursed the brakes as both slowed down and came to a halt on the shoulder. She'd executed the manoeuvre perfectly. Gamache doubted he could have done nearly as well.
Formidable, he said, and saw her smile.
Please don't ask me to do that again,
he laughed.
Believe me, Agent Cloutier, if that ever needs to be done again, you're the one I'll call.
Cameron had gotten out and was sliding toward them, gripping the cars as he went, finally stopping at Gamache's window.
That was impressive. Merci.
Bending in, he looked at Gamache.
What now?
Now?
Gamache grabbed his hat and gloves. We walk. Cloutier looked up the hill.
It's at least half a kilometre to their place.
Then we better get going, said Gamache, already out of the car and looking around.
The plump April snowflakes had stopped, and the air was cool and fresh. He took a deep breath and smelled sweet pine needles and musky leaves and mud. And heard.
What's that?
Asked Cloutier, cocking her head.
A river, said Cameron. It must have broken up. The spring runoff started.
Gamache turned toward the sound coming from deep in the woods. While the river could not be seen, it could be heard. The waters rushing down the side of the mountain. It was a sound as familiar to those in the Quebec countryside as sirens were in the city. When he'd left Three Pines early that morning to get into Montreal, all had been silent, except for the gentle tap-tap-tapping as the huge flakes landed on the trees and homes and vehicles. But something had broken. Something had woken in the meantime. Something not at all gentle. He took another deep breath, but with less pleasure. All sorts of things woke up in the spring, with the warmer weather, bears, chipmunks, skunks and raccoons, and rivers. They came to life. There were few things more powerful or destructive or terrifying than a hungry bear or a river in full flood. Gamache knew exactly where the river was heading. While he'd never been along this road before, he knew the area. They weren't all that far from his own village. Which meant the roar they heard was the Rivière Bella Bella heading straight into Three Pines. He took out his phone to call Renmarie, to warn her and find out how things were. But Cameron was right. There was no signal. He clicked the phone off, put it back in his pocket, and turned to look up the muddy road.
Come on,
he said. And started the climb.
The lottery ticket,
said Isabel Lacoste, looking over the file at Jean-Guy Beauvoir.
What?
Lacoste was between meetings. She'd dropped by to chat, and instead he'd put her to work, tossing her files and saying, take a look at these, tell me what you think. The two sat in companionable silence, reading about sometimes gruesome, sometimes straightforward, always tragic murders. Every now and then, Superintendent Lacoste had asked a question, or made a note, or a comment.
In the Anderson case, she said, the victim was found with a lottery ticket in her pocket.
Oui, a group of co-workers were in a pool.
Which she organised.
Yes. He leaned over so he could read the file she was holding. But it was a losing ticket.
Doesn't matter.
Then what does?
Everyone in her section was in the lottery pool, right? 10 people?
Yes.
But it says here there are 11 in that division. One was left out. Which one?
Beauvoir sat back and thought. It seemed a tiny detail, but that was the thing about murders and murderers. They hid in the details. The small things easily overlooked. You think whoever was left out killed her for the lottery ticket? But why not take it?
No,
Isabel was shaking her head. Then she suddenly looked at her watch. I'm going to be late for the next meeting.
But wait, why leave the ticket behind if that was the motive? Asked Beauvoir, calling after Lacoste as she made for the door.
Because the ticket wasn't the motive. Being left out was. And it probably wasn't the first time. What happens when someone is shunned over and over?
He grabbed the dossier and scanned it, muttering,
Merde, she might be right.
Chief Inspector Beauvoir called the lead investigator and suggested he find out all he could about the co-worker who had not been included. Then he sat back down and continued to go over the files. He was damned if he was going to leave a mess for his replacement, especially since he'd be spending holidays with that replacement for years to come. In 10 days' time, he and Annie would get on a flight to Paris with Honoré to start their new lives, and he to start a new job in private industry. It was almost impossible to believe. April in Paris. The trees would be in leaf. The gardens, laid out so formally, would be in bloom. Parisians would be sitting at sidewalk cafes, enjoying the warmth and their aperitifs. The city of light at its most luminous. He looked out his large window at Montreal. He couldn't see the top of Mont-Royal for the low-hanging clouds. While the snow had stopped, the gloom had not. Late spring in Quebec was beautiful. Early spring, on the other hand, was a pile of shit. Literally, in some cases, some places. He could almost smell it now. In the city, it was not really noticeable, but in the countryside. After years of visiting the Gamaches at their home in the tiny village of Three Pines, Jean-Guy had gotten much closer to nature, to the rhythms, the surprises, the miracles. Close enough to confirm that he hated the countryside. It was dirty and unpredictable, and it smelled. Beauvoir still harboured the suspicion that those who could live in Montreal or Quebec City but chose the countryside had at least one screw loose. This was confirmed when he'd first met the residents of Three Pines, and especially the old poet, who seemed to have lost all her screws and, as a result, spent her time screwing with others, or at least with Jean-Guy. It didn't help that many of the villagers were Anglophones, and Jean-Guy was an Anglophobe. They scared him, partly because while his English was good, he rarely caught the nuances or the cultural references. Who was Captain Crunch? Captain Kangaroo? Why so many captains? Why not generals? And why did they eat frites with ketchup and not mayonnaise? And how do you begin to explain plum pudding? It looked and smelled like early spring. And they ate it. Over time, he'd grown not just to like the village, but love the villagers, to accept their foibles, as they accepted his. But still, plum pudding? It sounded so good and tasted so bad. Anglos. His cell phone rang, and he answered immediately.
Salut, came the cheerful voice. Am I calling at a bad time?
If it was, I wouldn't answer. Though they both knew that wasn't true. Short of being in the middle of a shootout, when Annie called, he answered. A successful lawyer, Annie had arranged a transfer to the Paris office and was now studying to get her license to become an avocat in France.
Do you think you can go to Three Pines tonight? She asked.
I wasn't planning to. Why?
I just called Mom, and she told me the Bella Bella's going to flood.
It does every spring.
This seems different. She tried to sound casual, but I could hear that she's worried. She wanted to make sure Honoré and I weren't going down.
That bad? It would have to be near catastrophic for his mother-in-law to give up precious time with them. Jean-Guy dropped his feet off the desk and leaned forward.
They'll need help sandbagging, said Annie. Still, how bad can it be? It's the Bella Bella, not the St. Lawrence or the mighty Mississippi. The worst that can happen is water in the basements, right? It's never completely flooded before.
Beauvoir walked to the window. Lots of things never happened before, he knew, then suddenly did. It only took once. Murder, for instance. A person was only killed once, and that was enough. Yes, just because something had never happened, that didn't mean it couldn't, or wouldn't. And Annie was worried, otherwise she'd never have called and asked him to go down. After he hung up, he continued to look out the window. She'd mentioned the St. Lawrence. If the Bella Bella was flooding, what was the huge river that encircled the island of Montreal doing? Through the skyscrapers, he could see the river was still frozen. He sighed with some relief. Now, that would be a problem. But then he looked more closely, and as his eyes adjusted, he could see fissures and long shadows. That meant columns of ice had pushed their way up and out. Great chunks were piling up, and unless something happened soon, the St. Lawrence would also flood. And worse. The force of it could crush the pylons holding the bridges in place. He picked up the phone. As he waited for Chief Superintendent Toussaint to answer, he thought again about Paris, where the flowers were in bloom, where his little growing family would live in peace. Chapter 7 Awful, arrogant poseur. Hashtag Morrow sucks. Overrated, no talent. Hashtag Morrow sucks. Just plain shit. Hashtag Morrow sucks. Lock him up. Hashtag Gamache sucks. The donkeys noticed first. They turned in the field and started forward, toward the fence. One or two were braying. Carl Tracy came out and stood in the doorway of the barn and watched as three figures, covered in mud, trudged down the drive. They looked like something out of a horror film. Golems heading his way. Tracy reached over and took hold of the pitchfork. Gamache raised his hand in a fist to signal them to stop. Cameron, familiar with the silent combat gesture, did. Cloutier did not.
Agent Cloutier.
When she turned, Gamache nodded forward, and she saw it then. Framed in the open barn door was a man straight out of some horror film. He was dishevelled, filthy, with a pitchfork. Tracy watched them closely. The two men were large, dishevelled, filthy. The woman was small and filthy. He tightened his grip on the pitchfork.
Monsieur Tracy?
What do you want?
He shouted, in English. Gamache lifted his hands to show they held no weapon and stepped forward. Cameron instinctively went to join him to protect his quarterback, but once again Gamache gave him a signal. To stand down, but remain alert. The chief inspector took a few steps toward Tracy. There were at least 15 paces to go before they'd be face to face, but already he could smell the booze.
We're with the Sûreté du Québec, Gamache began, in English.
Get off my land.
My name is Chief Inspector Armand Gamache. This is Agent Cloutier, and this...
I know who that is.
Now that they were closer, Tracy recognised the man who'd threatened him with a beating not long ago.
Get him the fuck off my land.
He lifted the pitchfork and pointed it toward Cameron, making a small jabbing movement. It was a futile, almost comic gesture. But Gamache wasn't smiling. Instead, he put his arms out at his sides and took a few steps closer. Carl Tracy was in his mid-30s, slightly shorter, slightly lighter than Gamache. But where Gamache was solid, this man was not. As he jabbed, he jiggled. Still, Gamache knew it was never wise to underestimate anyone, especially someone with a pitchfork. He stopped.
We'd like to speak with your wife, please. Vivian Godin. Is she here?
No. I already told the cops that she's gone away.
And you haven't heard from her? She hasn't called?
No.
The only one who'd called him was her crazy father. Every hour, on the hour, even through the night. Threatening him.
but he wouldn't tell them that. He noticed Cameron had opened his jacket to reveal a gun on his belt. Shit. But the man standing just a few feet away, the guy in charge, displayed no weapon. In fact, he seemed to be trying to lull Tracy into some sort of trance, so deep and calm was his voice. When Gamache took another step toward him, Tracy also stepped forward and thrust the pitchfork at the cop.
Stop right there!
The sharp tines stopped within a foot of Gamache's face, but he didn't flinch. Instead, he looked right past the points, straight into Tracy's eyes. His gaze, Tracy saw with some alarm, wasn't angry, wasn't threatening, certainly wasn't frightened. It was thoughtful. Anger, rage, violence, Tracy could handle. But this was just confusing and off-putting and a little frightening. Gamache, a pitchfork away from Tracy, could see the bloodshot eyes and sense the havoc.
I'm going to reach into my pocket and bring out my Sûreté ID.
As he spoke, he did just that, watching the man closely. Tracy's nostrils flared with each breath, longing to attack. And he probably would have, Gamache knew, if it weren't for Cameron and his earlier threat to beat Tracy. This man obviously knew it was not an empty threat. While Gamache did not have a loaded gun, he did have Cameron, a biological weapon. Bringing out the card, he offered it to Tracy, who pushed his head forward and read.
It says here you're Chief Superintendent.
My new card hasn't arrived.
So you were the big boss, but not anymore?
Tracy was more with it than Gamache had given him credit for. Replacing the card, Gamache shrugged and smiled.
I messed up. It happens.
He looked at Tracy now with a slightly conspiratorial gaze, wanting Tracy to try to guess what he could possibly have done to warrant such a demotion. Gamache knew what a man like Tracy would naturally assume. It would have to be something illegal, almost certainly brutal. If Tracy thought Cameron was threatening, just wait for it. So now Tracy was well and truly confused. Gamache's manner was courteous, calm, but he intimated he was capable of something else.
What do you want?
Demanded Tracy.
Do you know what I'd really like?
What?
Water. And to use your phone.
What?
Do you mind? Asked Gamache.
It appeared such a reasonable, though random, request that Tracy was struck dumb for a moment.
There's a hose over there.
He gestured to the side of the barn.
I'll bring the phone out. Make your call, then leave.
Merci. I'm most grateful.
Everyone in the farmyard was now staring at Gamache with open astonishment, including the donkeys. But human behaviour often astonished them.
Are you okay, patron?
Asked Cameron when Tracy left. He'd walked over to the chief and scanned him for blood, concerned he might have hit his head on a rock in one of the many falls as they'd made their way, slipping and sliding up the hill.
How would you have had me handle this? Gamache asked as they walked over to the hose. Grab the pitchfork and beat him with it?
Cameron flushed. It was actually exactly what he'd expected and would have done. Gamache gestured to the others to take the water first.
You could have demanded to see Vivian, said Cloutier, reaching for the hose.
I did ask.
Ask, yes, but couldn't you have pushed harder?
To what end? Do you know what he'd have done? Run us off his property and he'd have had every right. We have no warrant.
Gamache glanced behind him to make sure Tracy wasn't approaching. Then he lowered his voice.
We have to assume we're dealing with a person capable of murdering his pregnant wife. And everything we've heard about him confirms he's abusive. Violent.
Gamache reached over and patted a donkey, taking in the barnyard as he did. He also assumed Tracy was watching them from the house. There were a lot of places to bury a body here, though he doubted that Carl Tracy would be stupid enough to put her on their own property. But then people did stupid things, like kill each other. And Carl Tracy did not strike him as the brightest of people. Besides, he held out some hope that Vivian Godin was indeed alive and had fled this terrible place.
Violence, threats, he understands, said Gamache quietly.
as though speaking to the donkey, who was now nuzzling him, leaving a slimy trail of drool and grass on his already filthy coat.
The best way to keep Carl Tracy off balance is to be courteous. Didn't you notice how confused he became?
So you want us to be nice to him?
Asked Cameron. Exactly. We can always ratchet it up later. Steps, degrees, and always keep something in reserve.
And, said Gamache, as he took the hose once Cameron had finished,
we have to keep something else in mind.
That he's a killer, said Cloutier.
Gamache bent over and drank. He was parched, and as he gulped, it struck him as ironic, and so like nature, to provide Tracy, a rancid man, with such sweet water.
That he might be innocent, said Gamache, lowering the hose, washing off his muddy hands, and turning off the tap.
Of murder, let's hope, said Cloutier, but not of beating his wife, his pregnant wife.
True, said Gamache, but we're here to investigate, not convict.
Try to keep your emotions in check. A clear head, right, Agent Cloutier?
Oui, patron.
You want the phone or not?
Shouted Tracy, stepping off the porch and holding the handset out.
Make the call and get off my fucking land!
Gamache clicked it on and heard a dial tone. Finally, a phone that worked. In the background, almost unnoticed now, was the sound of the Riviera Bella Bella rushing toward Three Pines. As Gamache dialed the number from memory, he watched Carl Tracy walk over to the donkeys, who nuzzled him, pushing him playfully. Tracy produced huge carrots and gave one to each. The phone rang a few times before being answered.
Oui, allô,
Gamache said, clearly relieved.
Yes, everything's fine. No cell phone coverage here, so I've had to borrow a phone. How are things with you?
I see.
Yes, sandbagging. Good idea.
I will.
He looked at Tracy, who'd, at the mention of sandbagging, turned from the donkeys with a look of some alarm.
But I do need a favour, said Gamache. I'm at the farm where Vivian Gaudin and her husband live. Carl Tracy refuses to answer questions or let us into the house or barn. I need a search warrant immediately. T-R-A-C-E-Y. Oui.
Tracy's face went slack, as though he'd been sandbagged.
You can call back at this number, continued Gamache. If you don't get an answer, send patrol cars up. They know the place. In fact, when the search warrant comes through, send them up to help search. But tell them the road is pretty much impassable. No, everything's fine. I'll let you know when we have more news about Madame Gaudin. Au revoir.
At Sûreté headquarters, Jean-Guy Beauvoir hung up and quickly made out a warrant request, then put in a call to a judge.
Yes, Your Honour, we need it immediately. Chief Inspector Gamache is on site and waiting. A woman is missing and perhaps murdered by her husband. I'm sending the request now.
He hit the send key.
Please let me know.
Then he hung up and looked out the window. The rain had begun. It was pissing April showers. Chapter 8. Gamache handed the phone back to Tracy with a smile.
Merci. Most helpful.
What the fuck was that?
You heard, Mr. Tracy.
In a few minutes, that phone will ring again. It'll be about a warrant to search your property. Best to answer it. Let's go into your house, and while we wait for the call confirming the search warrant, you can answer some questions.
Tracy's face hardened. He looked like an obstinate child.
Or not, said Gamache pleasantly.
But we're cold and wet, and would appreciate your cooperation.
He could almost hear Cameron and Cloutier gagging at his courteous tone. Tracy, it seemed, had gotten the point. He gestured for them to follow. The mud had hardened onto their coats and pant legs and boots. They looked and felt like Quebec's version of the terracotta warriors. The Sûreté officers took off their coats and boots, leaving them on the porch, but they couldn't very well remove their wet and filthy slacks. Tracy had no such hesitation about trailing muck through his house and had kept his rubber boots on. It was hot in the home,
almost stifling. An elderly mutt lay by the wood stove in the kitchen.
"Beer walk soon,"
said Tracy, gesturing toward the dog. Gamache knew what that meant, though the others did not. He looked past the grey muzzle into the tired old eyes and thought of the walk into the woods with the rifle, and wondered if the same fate had befallen the dog's mistress. Dishes, pots and pans were piled into and out of the sink. The place stank of grease and rotting food, booze and old dog and cigarettes. The smell was almost overpowering. Gamache took a deep breath through his nose, wondering if, in the sweltering heat, he could pick up another scent. Something familiar, something unmistakable, something far worse. But he could not. It was, perhaps, masked by the other rotting odours, but he doubted it. There was really no masking that one putrid stench. The three Sûreté officers had joined Tracy at the Formica kitchen table. Tracy lit a cigarette, while Cloutier and Cameron waited for Gamache to do something. But he was doing something. Armand Gamache was listening. For a sound, however remote, telling him that there was someone else in the home. A tapping, a muffled call. Anything. But there was only silence. Finally, he said,
"Monsieur Tracy, you say your wife isn't here. Do you know where she is?"
Cloutier had brought out her iPhone and was recording everything.
"I already told you, cops. All I know is when I woke up yesterday morning, she was gone. No note, no nothing."
"Any ideas?" Tracy laughed.
"She could be anywhere, on a bender, shacked up with some guy. I tell you, when she comes back..."
He remembered too late who he was talking to.
"Yes," said Gamache. "Go on."
"Nothing."
Armand Gamache had looked across lots of tables, at lots of murderers. He didn't kid himself that he had, even after all these years, some sort of special talent to spot a killer. He didn't really know if he was looking at one now, but he found himself increasingly repulsed by Carl Tracy. "We understand from Vivian's father that she's pregnant."
"Yeah. Who knows who knocked her up? Doubt it's mine. And if she thinks I'm going to raise the bastard, she has another thing coming."
"And what would she have coming?" asked Gamache. Tracy smirked.
"How would you feel if your wife screwed another man and got pregnant?"
Gamache raised his chin and stared at Tracy. And Carl Tracy stared back across the table into those calm, focused eyes and knew that while that shot had missed, this Sûreté officer was human and therefore vulnerable. And he'd find that chink eventually.
"Aren't you at all worried about her?"
asked Agent Cloutier. Tracy took his eyes from Gamache and shifted to the woman cop.
"Why should I be? Look, like I said, she's probably just taken off. And when that guy gets tired of her, she'll come back. I don't even know why it's any of your business."
Just then the phone rang.
"You might as well answer it," said Tracy. "It's for you."
Gamache clicked it on, but before he could say anything, he was met with a torrent of abuse, culminating in the man shouting,
"Where's my daughter? If you don't tell me, I'm coming down, and I'm going to beat it out of you, do you understand?"
Everyone in the room heard the voice, and Gamache could see Tracy looking triumphant. "See what I had to put up with," his expression said.
"Monsieur Gaudin,"
Gamache began.
"Who is this?"
"My name is Gamache. I'm with the Sûreté..."
"Oh, God, has something happened? Have you found her? Oh, God!"
"No, monsieur, we have no news of your daughter. I'm here with Lucette Cloutier. She's a friend of yours, I understand. Agent Cloutier asked us to investigate."
There was heavy breathing on the other end as Gaudin composed himself.
"We're interviewing Monsieur Tracy right now."
"Monsieur Tracy? Monsieur? The man's a monster, and you call him monsieur? He might have... He could have... Do you know she's pregnant?"
"Yes. Please, calm yourself. We're doing all we can, I promise you. We'll find her."
"You will? Alive?"
It was said so pathetically. Not just a word, but a world. Alive. Alive. And all that meant. For him, for her, for the child. A life spread out before them,
with birthdays and holidays, celebrations. Alive. We'll find her, Gamache repeated, and wondered if Monsieur Godin noticed he hadn't said alive. Do you have someone with you?
No, no. Vivian's my only child. My wife died a few years ago. I was expecting her here, you know. She was going to leave him. I begged her for years to leave that son of a bitch.
There was a pause. Gamache heard heavy breathing, almost sobs, before Monsieur Godin was able to speak again.
What has he done with her? Ask him. He knows. Make him tell you. If you don't, I will.
Stay at home, Monsieur Godin, in case she calls.
Even as he said it, Gamache recognized it as cheap, potentially cruel manipulation. But he had to keep Godin away from Tracy, and there was still a chance his daughter was alive and would call her father.
I'll be in touch with you when we're finished here, d'accord?
There was a deep, deep breath on the other end of the line, and finally,
d'accord.
Can I speak to him? Whispered Cloutier,
her hand out for the phone.
Homer, it's Lisette. Oui. Oui. I promise. Oui.
She'd dropped her eyes to the table and was listening intently. Homer Godin's voice was now quieter, so the others couldn't hear what he was saying.
Chief Inspector Gamache will call you as soon as possible, said Cloutier,
once Vivian's father had stopped talking.
Oui. I promise.
Her voice, gentle, calming, seemed to be having an effect. After saying goodbye, she placed the phone on the table.
The man's a shithead,
said Tracy, speaking to the phone as though it were his father-in-law.
You heard him threaten me. He's the dangerous one.
Enough,
said Cameron, hitting the table with such force that the ceramic roosters took flight and spilled salt and pepper over the table.
Agent Cameron, said Gamache sharply.
Sorry,
he muttered, bringing himself under control. Gamache shifted his attention back to where it belonged. How long have you and Madame Godin been together?
I don't know. 4, 5 years.
How did you meet?
It was in a bar. Where do you think? Church? The gym? Look, I have things to do around the farm. Those animals need to be fed, and this one needs to be taken into the woods.
He gestured toward the old dog, who looked up and gave a single, tired flop of his tail.
Like you took Vivian? Asked Cloutier.
What? Kill her?
He made a dismissive noise.
Why would I? Believe me, she's alive.
Try as he might, Gamache couldn't get Monsieur Godin's voice out of his head. The deep breaths, the attempt to control the terror that seeped out anyway, the desperation of a father. How would he feel if... You said she had lovers. He was careful to keep his tone neutral. Can you give us names?
Of course not. She didn't exactly list them.
And women friends? Gamache asked.
Women? No. Why would she?
It was as Cameron had said. Tracy had isolated his wife here, and since there was no one to contradict him, he was free to say anything he wanted about her.
We're going to need the make, model, and license plate number of her car, said Cameron.
Tracy gave them the information.
Where were you on Saturday? Gamache asked.
I was here, working on my pots. Where else?
Anybody see you?
Vivian did. You can ask her when she gets back.
Anyone besides your wife?
No. Who'd come here?
Who indeed, thought Gamache.
So you never left the property on Saturday?
No. Wait a minute. I did go into town to buy supplies. Needed to get them before the road turned shitty. Can't drive on it now.
He eyed them closely.
Well, that's probably not news to you.
And yet, said Cloutier, you say your wife managed to drive out later in the day.
There was silence, and they could see Tracy's brain skidding in the muck. She could, but you couldn't, Cloutier pressed.
She left at night, when the roads had frozen again.
He'd hit on an explanation bordering on reasonable. After Tracy had given them the names of the stores he'd visited, Gamache asked, When was the last time you saw your wife?
Saturday night, like I said. We'd been drinking. Vivian got pissed and started yelling abuse. told me the kid wasn't mine. I went into my studio to do some work and get away from her. When I got up next morning, she was gone.
The phone rang.
You take it,
said Tracy. Gamache picked it up and listened.
Bon. Merci.
He hung up.
We have the warrant.
Chapter 9. Like the rest of the house, the bedroom was a shambles. Bed unmade, bedding dirty. A partly drunk bottle of beer was on the floor next to the bed. An ashtray was overflowing with butts. In the bedside table, there was a small stash of pot and rolling papers.
Yours? Gamache asked Tracy.
Hers.
Gamache nodded, taking that in, but not necessarily believing it. The clock radio blinked 12 o'clock. Gamache stood in the middle of the room and turned full circle. Clothing was left on the floor where it fell. Socks, underwear, sweaters, jeans. Not just one day's worth, but days and days. An agent was going through the closet and the dresser drawers, photographing and cataloguing what was there. It was very difficult to tell if anything had been taken. Gamache asked Tracy about the clothes. Were they all his? Were some Vivian's?
All mine.
In Vivian's closet, clothing was hung up. Her drawers were a bit haphazard, with underwear and turtlenecks and jeans shoved in, but at least clean and off the floor. Looking at the top of the dresser, he noticed jewellery. Inexpensive, bright, bulbous. No photographs, though. She might have taken those with her. Gamache hoped that was true.
Is there a suitcase missing? Gamache asked.
Suitcase? We don't have any of those. Why would we?
Gamache nodded. That alone was pretty telling, and slightly chilling. In the bathroom, Gamache pointed to a toothbrush.
Is this hers?
No, that's mine. This is hers.
Tracy pointed to the other one in the holder. The bristles were worn almost flat. Maybe she'd left this one and bought a new one, Gamache thought. He hoped that was true. The forensics officer bagged both brushes for DNA testing. Gamache opened the medicine cabinet. Nothing extraordinary there. No prescriptions, just cold meds and ointments. There were no gaps on the narrow shelves. Nothing obviously missing. Then he left and walked from room to room, with Tracy following him, a shadow. Other officers arrived and were searching the outbuildings.
There's no sign of her, patron, reported Agent Cloutier.
She found him in the living room, kneeling by the sofa.
But they have found something just off the kitchen.
I'll be right along. Merci.
He brought out a pen and moved a potato chip wrapper aside. Then, standing up, he called to the forensics officer in the room.
Can you check this, please?
He stepped away and turned to Tracy.
I think it's blood.
Is it?
Could be. Might be hers, might be mine. Who knows?
We will, soon. What happened here?
I told you, we got into a fight.
You hit her?
And she hit me. Gave as good as she got. Look, I know you think I've done something, but I didn't. I left her here.
He pointed to the sofa.
Alive.
Check the rest of the room carefully, Gamache advised the officer. Brushing past Tracy without a word, Gamache followed Agent Cloutier into the kitchen and through a door he'd assumed was a pantry, but instead it led into what had once maybe been an outhouse, or a pigsty, or chicken coop. It had been knocked through to connect to the main house. He stood at the door and prepared himself. Clearly there was no body inside, he'd have been told right away, nor was this an obvious crime scene. Again, he'd have been told. But it did strike him as a place where unpleasant things might have happened to animals or people. He went in. What struck him first was the extraordinary heat. The agents working in there were perspiring and trying not to drip sweat and contaminate the room. On seeing him, they stood up and started to salute. But with a gesture, he stopped them and indicated they should continue working. Then he looked around. Not a slaughterhouse at all. Not an old outhouse. It was much larger than that. An old garage, converted into a workshop. No, not a workshop. A studio. He saw a potter's wheel, He saw plastic bags filled with clay, their tags still on. The walls were lined with shelves holding unglazed pieces. He saw what Cameron had meant. No one could possibly use Tracy's works for anything practical. They wouldn't hold food or drink or flowers. But they did hold the attention, not unlike the man himself. Carl Tracy seemed an unfinished, partially formed man, soft, useless. And yet there was also something about the man, not attractive. In fact, Gamache felt repulsed by him, but he also felt his eyes returning to him. Carl Tracy was a presence. There was no denying that. A statement piece, like his works. But while his pottery looked, to Gamache's eye, good, Tracy did not. Gamache turned and saw in the corner the source of the extraordinary heat. A kiln. It had obviously been fired up in the last day or so. Kneeling down, he looked into the opening in the bottom of the kiln. It was filled with ash.
"Make sure you collect this," he said, straightening up. "Have you found anything?"
"Not yet," said the agent in charge. "If there's any blood here, it'll be impossible to hide or clean. The bricks and clay are porous. If it's here, we'll find it."
"Bon, merci."
He turned and saw Carl Tracy looking in.
"The kiln's been used recently," said Gamache.
"Yes, I was firing some works."
"When?"
"Saturday night."
"It's still hot."
"Takes a long time to cool down. Needs to be really hot to bake the clay."
He examined Gamache, then laughed.
"You don't think..."
He looked astonished.
"You actually think I stuck Vivian in there, piece by piece? Are you crazy? Do you know how much work that would be? And imagine the mess."
Gamache knew Tracy was trying to get under his skin, denying the murder and cremation of a woman and her unborn child, not because it was abhorrent, but because it was too much work.
"Look,"
Tracy said as he followed Gamache into the kitchen,
"it wasn't much of a marriage, but she did her thing, I did mine. Why would I kill her?"
"Why would you kill him?" Gamache pointed to the old dog, still lying by the warm stove.
"Because he's no use anymore. He can't hunt and isn't going to guard the place. He just eats and shits. Gonna get a new dog, a better dog."
"Maybe that's why you'd kill your wife," said Gamache, "so that you could get a new one."
"Why kill her? I just chuck her out."
"Because she'd take you to court and get half the property," said Gamache.
"Yes,"
said Tracy, nodding.
"That would be a good reason."
It was as close to a confession, without actually being one, that the head of homicide had heard. Tracy looked down at the dog.
"He's not mine, he's hers. Came with her, and he can leave with her. The sooner the better."
He made a shooting gesture with his hand. The dog struggled up, took a step closer to Tracy, and licked the trigger finger. They found nothing. After conferring with the local agents, it was decided they'd done all they could. It was time to leave.
"What do we do now?"
asked Agent Cameron as they put on their coats and boots. They stepped onto the porch and looked around, at the acres and acres, miles and miles, of forest, at the donkeys in the field, patiently watching them. And they heard again the growl of the Bella Bella from deep in the woods. It seemed louder, closer.
"First step is to declare Vivian Godin missing," said Gamache, "and then to visit her father."
A large drop landed with a plop at the foot of the steps, then another. He looked up. It was early afternoon, but the clouds were so thick and the sun so obscured that it felt like dusk or an eclipse. Gamache put his hand in his pocket, but remembered that there was no cell phone coverage.
"Can you give us a lift back to our cars?" Gamache asked one of the agents.
"Absolutely, sir. I saw them when we arrived, just down the hill."
"Right. How did you manage to get up the hill?"
"We didn't. We came around and down from the other side."
She glanced again at the chief inspector's clothing. He and the others looked like they'd crawled up the muddy slope on their hands and knees to this terrible place, which they practically had.
"Do you have a radio in your car?" asked Gamache.
"Yes, sir. We're all equipped with them, in case our phones don't work."
"Good."
Gamache turned to Carl Tracy, who just stepped onto the porch, the old dog at his side.
"We'll be in touch with more questions, I'm sure."
"He's done it, hasn't he?"
said Agent Cloutier as they walked to the Sûreté vehicle. Killed her. Gamache said nothing, but looked grim. Once at the car, he leaned in and, taking the handset off its hook, identified himself and asked to be put through to Chief Inspector Beauvoir of Homicide. As he waited, more rain fell. Tracy disappeared off the porch and reappeared with a .22 rifle.
How does he have that? Asked Gamache. Does he have a permit?
Unfortunately, yes, said Cameron. He's never been convicted of an offence, so there's no way to take it from him. We didn't find any others.
Gamache shook his head. As strict as the laws were governing firearms in Canada, they could be tighter.
Here was a man known to abuse his wife, and he's allowed to have a gun?
Did you test it? Has it been fired recently?
We tested, and no, it hasn't been fired in a while.
Gamache looked into the dog's eyes and knew that was about to change.
There you are, finally, Beauvoir's voice came out of the tinny speaker. Did you get my messages?
No, we're out of cell phone coverage. About what?
A state of emergency's been declared. Leaves have been cancelled. There's flooding across the province. Looks bad.
The dams?
Hydro's sending engineers up there now to assess the situation.
If they burst. But Gamache didn't say it. They all knew what would happen if the massive hydroelectric dams in James Bay were breached. But that wasn't the only potential disaster.
Where's the worst flooding?
Beauvoir detailed it. As he spoke, Gamache visualized the map of Quebec and saw the danger points, where rivers met larger rivers. Inevitably, that was also where towns and cities had been built, at the junction of the great waterways.
The St. Lawrence?
He asked, and held his breath. Though in his heart, he knew the answer already. He'd seen the ice build up just a few hours earlier, and had called it in. Beauvoir quickly and succinctly described the affected areas, ending with the worst hit.
Montreal.
Montreal, repeated Gamache.
I've been trying to reach you. There's a meeting here they want you at, starting in half an hour. How soon can you get back?
Gamache looked at his watch.
I can be there in 40 minutes.
Hurry.
Jean-Guy.
Oui?
The Bella Bella.
Still rising.
Gamache looked south, toward his village. He could be there in minutes. Then he looked north, to Montreal.
Merci, said Gamache. I'll be there as soon as possible.
He gave the handset back to the agent and started to walk around to the passenger side, but paused.
Sir?
Asked the agent. The car was running, waiting.
Un moment, said Gamache.
As the others watched, the chief inspector walked back to the porch, took out his wallet, placed bills at Tracy's feet, then walked back to the car, the old dog in his arms. As he got in, he said,
His name's Fred.
Chapter 10. The patrol car slid down the road, but the agent managed to guide it to where they'd left their vehicles. She dropped them off and continued down the hill, opening the windows to air out her once pristine vehicle, that now smelled of old wet dog and mud and donkeys.
What do we do now, patron?
Asked Cameron as they stood in the rain outside their cars.
You return to your station. You'll be needed for flood control or evacuations. We're heading back to Montreal.
Once in the car, Agent Cloutier asked,
What about Vivian? What do I tell Homer?
I'll call him once we're out of the mountains and have communications.
Rain was hitting the windshield. The clouds were low, mingling with the mist clinging to the forest.
Can I stay on it, though? Keep looking for her?
You'll do as you're ordered, Agent Cloutier, said Gamache. As will I. He turned toward the woods, where the Bella Bella, invisible, was rushing toward the valley and the village. Ruth stood at the top of the fieldstone bridge and watched the activity around her. The whole village was out, filling sandbags. It was something they did most springs, but until now it had been a precaution that had morphed into a tradition that had become a party, a celebration, to mark the end of a long winter. The spring runoff often coincided with the running of the maple sap.
They'd fill sandbags and hold a sugaring-off party with baked beans and crepes and cauldrons boiling down the sap into syrup. A fiddler played as children and Gabri stood around the pots waiting to pour the sweet liquid onto snow, where it turned into a sort of soft caramel called tire d'érable. While mothers and fathers, friends and neighbours filled sandbags to build walls along the Bella Bella, children and Gabri used twigs to roll the tire, then ate the maple candy and watched horses return from the forest bearing buckets brimming with more sap. It was a festive end to winter. After all, the river had never broken her banks. There'd never been reason to worry. But today was different. The fiddler was holding a shovel. The kids were safely in St. Thomas's Church, their evacuation centre. There was no tear, only tired and sodden villagers. Ruth stood in the rain, almost sleet, and watched as they bowed, then straightened, then bowed again, filling the sandbags in what looked like a pagan ritual. But if this was a ritual, it was to an angry, vindictive deity. "I just sit where I'm put, composed of stone and wishful thinking," Ruth muttered one of her own poems as she watched her neighbours and friends bow and lift, bend and shovel. "That the deity who kills for pleasure will also heal." Villagers, under Ruth's direction, had formed two lines and were passing the bags along, then piling them one on top of the other, building a wall on either side of the Bella Bella. The old poet turned from surveying her dripping and dirty neighbours and looked upstream. She tried not to let her face reflect her feelings. Gnawing her cheek to stop the fear from showing, she looked at the Bella Bella. Until recently, it had been beige with froth, but now it was almost black. As the churning became more and more violent, dredging up muck and sediment and God knew what else from the river bottom. Things left undisturbed for decades, centuries perhaps, were now roiling to the surface, rotten, decayed. Ruth watched as the bloated river swept great chunks of ice and tree limbs down the mountain, crashing toward them, jamming, then breaking apart. But eventually, she knew, the jam would be too dense, the debris too solid. It would hold, and then... Until this day, the villagers had considered the Bella Bella a friendly, gentle presence. It would never hurt them. Now, it was as though someone they thought they knew well, someone they loved and trusted, had turned on them. The only thing more shocking would be if the three huge pine trees in the centre of the village broke free and began to attack them. Gabri and Olivier were handing out hot drinks, tea, coffee, hot chocolate and soup. Monsieur Béliveau, the grocer, and Sarah, the baker, were taking around trays of sandwiches. Brie and thick slices of maple-cured ham, and arugula on baguettes and croissants, and pain ménage. Though the most popular proved to be the ones Reine-Marie had made before she took a place in the line, filling sandbags. "God," said Clara, taking a huge bite, "these are delicious." Her gloves were wet through, and her large hands trembled in the cold. "What do you have?" asked Myrna, as she swallowed a huge bite of baguette.
"Peanut butter and honey on Wonder Bread," said Clara, barely intelligible through the thick peanut butter.
"Oh, jeez," said Myrna, breaking from the line and turning to look for Sarah the baker. "I'm going to get one of those."
"Here," said Billy Williams. "Take mine."
Though he was famished, he offered her half his sandwich. Myrna smiled and shook her head.
"It's okay. I'll get my own. But thanks."
Billy looked after her, then down at his damp sandwich, and understood that he had nothing that Myrna wanted. She was unattainable, and he worried he'd love her for the rest of his life. Gabri walked over to the bridge and offered Ruth a coffee.
"I put a shot of brandy in it."
"That's okay,"
shouted the old poet over the sound of the river. She reached for a steaming mug.
"I'll take the soup."
Gabri paled. It was, he knew, a sign of the end of days, Ruth refusing booze. He looked down and saw that the river was not just angry, there was a madness about it, as though all the indignities visited on all the waterways in the New World by generations of settlers were coming to the surface. The waters were rising up,
not in protest, but in revenge. He could barely hear himself think for the howling. It was, he thought as he walked off the bridge, the sound a soul might make as it approached hell. Gamash's mind was racing. Had they thought to open the spillways for the dams across the province? Hospitals needed to be put on alert. Other provinces contacted and asked for possible assistance. The water filtration plants needed to be protected. Hydro crews needed to be ready to restore power. Military reserves and first responders called out. Emergency measures put in place. A sudden catastrophic event, natural or otherwise, brought with it turmoil. Places so pastoral and pretty one minute became war zones the next. A populace unused to these sudden emergencies needed to be rallied and directed and kept calm. It was vital to take control. Gamash tried to stop his mind from going there and his hand from reaching for his phone to call emergency management, call his successor at the Sûreté, call the Premier Ministre and tell them what to do. Instead, he took a deep breath and forced himself to sit back in the passenger seat. This was no longer his job, no longer his responsibility. They knew what they were doing. They did not need him. Still, he felt like a swimmer treading water offshore, watching some terrible event unfold on the mainland and being unable to stop it, or even help. Once out of the mountains, his phone had gone wild with emails, texts, phone messages. He tried Renmarie first and finally got through to Olivier in the bistro, who called Renmarie in.
"We're all right, Armand. Sandbagging, of course, but there's no panic."
Ruth didn't
put Valium in the hot chocolate.